Everybody, welcome to another exciting episode of Data Exposed. I'm your host, Scott Klein, and with me in the studio again back is Maxim. Maxim, welcome back.
Scott. Yeah, thank you.
So let's get started, but why don't you introduce yourself real quick for those who...
Sure. I'm Maxim Lukyanov, Program Manager on HD Insight team, working on Spark and other big data technologies in Azure.
Yep, cool. So we've done one video on Spark performance, which is awesome. It was a great kind of introduction into how we think about Spark and start thinking about tuning Spark, right? This is number two in the series, because I think we're going to do three or four of these.
Yeah, something about that. Yeah. So now we covered kind of intro and how things work, and now we can get into actually how you make it work, what the tuning techniques you can use.
Yeah, and as someone myself who, you and I were talking before, as we start thinking about, hey, how do I start playing with Spark? You know, these are kind of things that I'm very interested in, right? And so hopefully other people. So what do you got for us today?
Well, today we'll start with some very kind of getting started experience type of questions.
Yep.
Like we work with customers and we have to go through this like time and time over again. When people get started on Spark, there's this question that you need to answer in order to do things with understanding what you're doing.
Yeah.
So we'll cover those things that kind of unblock you and let you kind of make the right choices when you kind of starting using Spark.
Cool. Okay. Awesome. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Things I'm interested in. All right.
Well, so what do we have first? Oh, data sets. So for that one, let's immediately switch to the code, some code. So one of the first questions that you need to answer when you start using Spark is, hey, what APIs do you use? Because unfortunately, there are three, and that can be confusing. Like you can use data sets, you can use data frames, or you can use RDDs. So which one do you use?
Good question.
Okay, good question. So,
data sets. You know, and that's for a .NET person type of thing. That's kind of what we immediately go to, right?
Well, so. I won't say is it right or wrong. Just to don't like.
That's one option. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one option.
Okay.
So let's start with kind of a bottom to the top. So the first one is RDDs, and the answer for this one is fairly simple. Like the RDDs were original data set APIs of Spark in 1.x era.
Okay.
So they're kind of legacy APIs, and for that reason, you can say, oh, it's the old one, so probably I'm not supposed to use that.
Okay.
And that is actually true, but they're actually still convenient, and if you look at how you use them, you can see that, oh, if I want to parse some data, let's say it's a CSV data file, then in RDD APIs, it will look like you will first parse the actual text. You'll say you'll split it into separate fields.
Okay.
And then you can do a very powerful thing in Spark. That's why it's originally kind of gained its popularity, because it was a very powerful technique. You can convert your unstructured data into a structure. So here we have this person class defined over here in Scala. It's very nice and clean and simple.
Okay.
And you can say that, hey, I want to work with my data in the terms of person class.
So So it's getting it from here. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the definition of the class, and now I'm using that class over here.
Okay.
So basically, I did my manual parsing of the CSV file.
Okay.
And
so like you said, we're taking it from sort of unstructured to structured.
Yeah. So you basically define the structure on top of your unstructured data.
Okay.
And now it's very easy in Spark RDD APIs to do anything with it, like aggregations, what have you. In this example, we have the simple filter. And this is a Scala syntax of saying that, hey, for every row that I have, take its age field and compare it with the number 30. And if it's more than 30, then use it, otherwise drop it. So
okay.
It's a simple filter.
Okay.
So, but the nice property of that is that you can use your kind of strongly typed language to make sure that your program runs correctly at compile time.
Sweet.
It will tell you if you... like using some using wrong field or something.
Okay.
So that's very nice.
So RDDs have been around for
from 1.x.
1.x, okay.
For a long time.
Okay.
The disadvantage of those RDDs APIs is that they don't take advantage of any of the optimizations we talked in the previous episode where we talked about this tungsten engine. So you don't get
a
predicate pushdown, you don't kind of get any optimizations of the query plan that Spark can now do.
So there's limitations to using RDDs, right? Okay.
So from the performance point of view, it is not as fast as the other two options.
Okay.
So now going up, so now if you're talking about data frames, so that's Spark 2.x artifact, so that's APIs of Spark 2.x.
Okay.
And here you can see that now we're switching, we can switch easily to JSON file because one of the advantages of data frames and data sets that they have this notion of data source.
So I can't use JSON with RDDs?
Yeah.
Okay.
it's easy to use. You can use JSON with RGDs, but it's just not as easy to parse it out.
Oh, I see. Okay.
In data frames, it just
it's much easier to do.
It's built in. Yes.
You just say, into the API. You're saying.
Yeah. Okay. You just say, hey, it's a JSON file, and then Spark automatically will parse this JSON file into structured data for you, and you can immediately start filtering and doing all of the stuff with it. So the parsing stuff is done for you by Spark automatically.
Oh, really? So the spark.read.json automatically says parse it for me.
Yeah.
I don't have to do the dot map, you know, dot split, dot map, dot row, and things like that.
So you don't need to parse it manually. Okay. There is a JSON parser built in.
Okay.
And it knows how to present this JSON data in the form of the data frames, so you can immediately start doing filters and anything with it. And in data frames, it looks like this. You say, hey, my data frame name, and then you specify name of the column of the string, and you do your conditions and everything else.
Okay.
And that's a slight difference from RDDs. You see, in RDDs, we can use a real class person to manipulate our data. In data frames, we cannot. So that's the disadvantage. Now you have to go back into this kind of a key value type of metaphor. You have to work with dictionaries. So it's not strongly typed, basically.
Okay, yep.
But the big advantage of the data frames is that now they turn on all of the tungsten optimizations, and now it's all kind of a very fast and code-generated code.
So with data frames, I can take advantage of the things we talked about in the last episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the fastest API Spark has at the moment.
Okay. Yep.
And finally, if you go back, go up into a data set, so that's the APIs that combine advantages of data frames and RDDs.
Yeah, I was looking at that going, that's a combination of RDDs and data frames, right?
Yeah, exactly. You can see it from the code.
Yep.
Basically, in a
strongly typed.
Yeah, in a slightly different syntax, it is strongly typed, as you said. Yeah. And you can use all of the fields from your person class to manipulate your data.
Okay. So from your comment, I'm trying to remember what you said. So this is supported in 2.x.
Yeah, but this is also 2.x.
Okay. Yeah. So is there any reason why I would use? I mean, if I'm using 1.x, I'd obviously want you to do this. If I haven't, right? But is there any reason if I'm doing 2.x, I'd use one over the other?
That's a great question. So how do you choose? Like, from the syntax point of view and programmer point of view, you would always prefer doing something in a strongly typed world.
Because
it just.
Yeah. As a
developer, it just looks nicely.
Yeah.
Like that's actual.
It's probably easier to do, you know, because you're.
Yeah. And it gives you some advantages of compile time checks and all of that stuff. But the unfortunate kind of reality is that it doesn't come for free from the performance point of view. Because all of those kind of lambda functions that you specify here inside of this filter, they operate over this person object. And that implies that Spark now needs to create this person objects for you for every row of this data in order to apply this filter.
Oh, that's right. You said from a performance standpoint, I think your comment was, this is better performing.
This is fastest, yes.
Ah, okay. Even if I'm applying some of the tungsten and some of the other things we talked about in the last episode, this is still faster.
Yeah. Tungsten will be applied here, so all of the benefits of query optimization will be applied. But inside of this nice and optimized query, you will get this ugly serialized person object.
So even that
do the function and then deserialize it back into this native binary data.
This is still faster then.
Yeah. So this is much faster.
Ah,
yeah.
So
not always it's much faster, but it's faster period.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. This is
Maybe it depend on what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. The answer to that would be it depends. Would that be the answer? Like, which one I use?
There is still depends, yes. So there is some cases when it's okay to use data sets, when you don't care about performance that much, or when the performance isn't that great. Yeah. Okay. Well, smaller data set is fine, but even if you do something simple, like if you're doing just some mapping of the data or some ETL, initial phase of ETL process, where overhead of creating this person objects isn't that big, then it's fine. So the benefits outweigh the cost.
Okay.
But if you're doing something more advanced, like aggregations and things where you actually process the data, then this overhead starts to add up. And then you say, oh, no, let me go back to data frame. So the performance overhead of this one, this actually goes back to the same topic we discussed in the previous episode, that Java, unfortunately, as a runtime for big data, isn't perfect. So it adds its overhead. So there is no this zero cost abstractions that you can.
Well, it doesn't look that much harder to use, for a data frame over it, right? Yeah, and I guess that would depend on the complexity of your of the data too, right?
Yeah, well, when complexity of your pipeline grows, the structured and kind of typed approach pays off. Like then your code reads better and just simpler, and you can create your functions and classes and factor out various pieces of your application in different places. So it helps you keep working on the large projects. But at the price of performance.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Cool. Okay. I love that explanation. Great. Yeah, that can.
Okay, so now we can kind of choose our APIs and move to the next topic.
We picked our API, moving on. Yeah.
Yeah, moving on. So the next topic is actually even more complicated than the first one.
Yep.
So now that you're ready to go, you know how you want to write your code and you're ready to get started. Unfortunately, you need to still kind of make some choices. Basically, we can even switch back to this code. And so if you remember the script that we used in the previous episode to run some queries, when you run your Spark shell, you need to specify parameters like how many executors you have.
Oh, right.
And then this nasty one's like, hey, how many cores should the executor have? How much memory should I assign to each executor? How do you choose? Like, how do you know what's the right answer? So, and you need to make these choices in any Spark, like either you use Spark shell or something else, like notebooks, you still behind the scenes need to make these choices in order to create your Spark application in the first place.
I see, yep, okay, yep.
So like this picture illustrates like a very simple case, like even if you have two nodes, like let's say Worker node 1 and 2, you can create executors in at least two combinations. You can say, hey, all of my resources of the node, let's say we have 16 cores and 30 gigabytes, will go to a single executor. So I'll create this one large executor per node. Or you can do the slightly different. You say, hey, I want to divide resources of my Worker node into two executors, and each one will have 8 cores and 15 gigabytes of RAM.
Okay.
So how do you choose between the two?
Yeah. So you got some options, but Is this a case where you're going, I just might have to execute this way and execute this way and figure out which performs better?
Well, that's what people have to do if they don't know better. Like, you have to experiment. You have to do this multiple experiments to find out what's the best configuration, and that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
So, fortunately, there is some pieces that we can share that work well. So, the first one is basically the first enemy that you need to think about is, again, this nasty garbage collection overhead. So obviously, the bigger the process, the more garbage collection overhead it has, and at some point it becomes unbearable.
Yeah.
And then you have to start splitting things up. So that's kind of the first
factor,
but there are more of them.
Okay.
Basically, there are factors that say, hey, you want to keep executors smaller, like the garbage collector one, collection one being the primary factor.
Okay.
But there are also many factors to keep it larger, and especially if you look at like communication overhead, there are actually very strong arguments to keep your executors large for larger clusters, because then you kind of reduce your communication overhead between nodes in your cluster, and you can actually work efficiently on a larger data set.
When you say keep the executives large, you mean in terms of instead of multiple executives, bigger, instead of 8 executors, maybe 4 executors with more memory and cores.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is a large executor, where you assign all of the cores into it, and this is a smaller executor where you can start dividing things up. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's a factors, and garbage collection being the primary one of them, but there's also many others.
Yeah.
So if you talk about, hey, so how do I deal with all this complexity? So we have developed this kind of a simple steps, and I outlined them here so people can kind of visualize them.
Are these sort of best practices that we've put in place based on our learnings?
Yeah, so basically we did various performance studies and experiments with customers. And this is simplified steps. Again, there is many factors that we listed that influence it, but this is a very good kind of a starting point.
Yeah, start here, then based on what we've already talked about, you may have to. Okay.
Exactly. And basically, the rules or steps here are very simple. Like you start with limiting the memory that you assign to executor, because Java kind of behaves in a very bad way once you go beyond 30 gigabytes. So you start with limiting the memory, and then you can throw all of the cores that you have on the machine to a single executor as a starting point.
Okay.
In Spark 2.x, because of the tungsten execution engine, the overhead of GC is much more under control. So it, actually, in many cases, it you can kind of assign all of the cores into a single executor and kind of achieve the efficiency of that. And then you just go back and do some trial runs and see if it works or is there some of the factors that kind of limiting your performance.
Okay.
And we can even check how you check. We can see how you can check the overhead of, so this one is, so if you go into a Spark UI, so let's assume you configured your cluster with like with some configuration.
Yep.
Then you want to see, is it working or not?
Right.
So how do I check if my garbage collection like is under control or not?
Sure.
So in Spark 2.x, it has a very nice property where you can just go into executors tab here in the UI, and it will show you aggregated statistics across all executors of how much garbage collection time is, how much time Spark spends in garbage collection versus actual task time. So this is the actual task time, and this is a garbage collection time. So here you can see at a glance, hey, is it way too much in garbage collection or not?
Okay.
And Spark will even highlight the cells in red if it's if the garbage collection time exceeds 10%. So that makes it very easy for you to
based
it
on your
control.
And based on the slide you said, hey, if it goes above 10%, we're you're sort of out of bounds at that point.
Yep.
So we want this number.
This number, yeah.
10% or less of the task time.
Of the task time,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that makes it very easy for you to check the for GC problems. Now you just go to executor tab, check the thing, is it flashing red?
Yeah.
If it's not flashing red, you're good. If it's flashing red, then you see, take a look at this one. If it's within 10, 20%, maybe it's okay still.
Yeah.
If it's way more than that and it's not non-linear, like if you really have GC problems, it will go very quickly up.
Yeah.
Then you go back and start reducing size of your executor, splitting cores between multiple processes, and
okay.
things like
so
that.
So if I'm, let me make sure I understand what you just said. So if I'm, if I'm above the 10% or 20%, let's say, if it's mm-hmm. not acceptable, then I go back into my executors. I say, all right, I want bigger. Do I want bigger and more or?
Yeah, you basically reduce number of cores.
Okay, reduce the number of cores.
But you still want to use all of the cores that you have on your system. So,
yeah, okay.
So then you reduce number of cores, but increase the number of executors.
Okay, yeah.
And you still need to keep to make sure that your memory is still sufficient. So it's a problem of three variables that you need to kind of pin, what is a, you need to fit this buckets into the Worker nodes. Yeah.
Okay, yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so that makes sense. Cool.
So that's one of the biggest problems with getting started.
Okay.
And now that we have basically figured out what to write Spark programs in and how to run them, we can start optimizing things.
Okay. Yep.
And the first optimization question is: hey, when I query my data, what format of the data should I use? What is the fastest one?
Okay.
And here, there are two parts to the story. The first part is, if you're talking about the source of the data,
mm-hmm.
which your Spark jobs are processing, so big data in general is great in its ability to work with any kind of unstructured data.
Sure.
So usually you don't care about the source of the data. You just process it in whatever format it comes in.
Okay.
And Spark has support for a variety of formats, and this website has even more external packages to support even more formats and data sources. So in that way, connecting to the source of the data is very easy. You just connect to whatever format it is.
Sure, but just because it supports a lot doesn't mean that one performs better than the other.
Yeah, so it will perform like CSV text files will not perform very well from performance point of view.
Okay.
So they will be fairly slow to parse. Like it's you need to parse the whole thing.
Yeah.
So now once you kind of absorb the data into you like cleaned it up and joined maybe some few data sources together, and you're ready to create this data source that you're ready to query many times in subsequent jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So which format do you choose for that one?
Yeah.
So in Spark, the answer is very simple. Fortunately, it's Parquet because Spark is optimized for Parquet quite heavily.
Okay.
Yeah. And Parquet brings like state-of-the-art kind of techniques. It keeps data in a columnar format, okay. So it allows you to reduce amount of data that you scan when you process data.
Okay.
And it has optimized reader in Spark as well.
Okay.
Another alternative is ORC, but it's not as optimized for Spark. But
okay.
In terms of formats, it's almost the same. Yeah.
Okay. Sweet. So the because to summarize up to this point, I want to be able to use a format that's going to get me to the best performance. We might have to play with that a little bit, right? And then you said optimize that down into preferably Parquet because Spark's optimized for Parquet, right?
Yeah, when it comes to performance, if you have a choice of which format to choose, just choose Parquet. Yeah. That's simple answer.
Okay, but the data sources may not be in Parquet, so you're saying get all the data sources and then...
Yeah, just keep data sources in whatever formats they are in, in their native data sources. Native. Don't try to transform them like somewhere.
Yeah. But the data I want to work with, get that into Parquet,
is
what you're saying.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Good recommendation.
Cool.
Do we see, like you said, CSV isn't as performant, right? But, when people working with Spark, right?
Yeah.
Do we see the data more in JSON or, from initial formats? I mean, what's the, out of this list, I guess, what is the most popular that people are working with today?
Well, it depends on the kind of the application of the of the workload.
Yeah.
It kind of external to Spark. So you just work with the data
whatever's
in the
there.
Format that it comes. It comes very frequently these days in a JSON format if you're talking about login systems, all kind of a computer related stuff.
Okay.
There is plenty of data in CSV if you're talking about like garment data sets and kind of shareable data sets. That's still a very common format.
Okay.
Avro was used a little bit for kind of exchange of data, and you can find instances of that where people exchange data in Avro format. But another one is XML, of course. XML is like Wikipedia is in XML.
It's XML, okay.
So if you want to export Wikipedia, you'll have to deal with that.
Do the XML, okay. But you typically see CSV and JSON. Okay, cool.
Cool.
Awesome.
So what was the next step?
Now
that you covered the format, so now you kind of put the data in Parquet and you realize usually it's like a 6x or 10x gain in performance. So like you are excited when you like put your data in Parquet and it starts working like 10x faster.
Woo, okay.
Yeah, it's like amazing feeling. And now you want, I want more of that.
Right.
Like what's the next thing I can do?
Okay.
So the next very powerful technique when it comes to very large data sets is
partitioning. And getting better performance, right?
Yeah. We are talking purely from performance point of view. Yeah.
Okay.
So is partitioning.
Okay.
Like imagine you have your fast Parquet files here covering like data set from year 86 to year 2006.
Uh-huh.
So that would be 30 years?
Yep.
Or 20.
80, 20.
90. 20 years.
20 years, yep.
So you have your 20-year data set, but all of your queries usually like work with last 2 years.
Yep.
Or most of your queries work with last 2 years.
Yeah.
So the way it will work in Spark by default, if you don't use partitioning, for any queries that you run, you'll have to scan all the 20 years. That's just a kind of a bulk processing of data approach that all of the big data systems use.
Okay.
And you obviously...
You're saying it doesn't partition by default?
By default, it doesn't partition.
Okay, so it'll have to scan all 20 years.
All 20 years. Yeah, yeah. Like, if you want to, like, find a single row in year 2005, you would still have to scan all of the 20 years worth of data. And that could be, like, terabytes and terabytes of data. That's obviously not very efficient. Like, can we be smart about that?
Yep.
And yes, the answer is partitioning. So you have to basically decide which columns of your data allow you to
What's your partition key, essentially?
Yeah, exactly,
right?
We can just talk in these terms.
Like,
what's the partition key that would allow you to, like, for most of your queries, dramatically narrow the data set that you need to scan? So you basically define, in this case, partitioning by year. And then when you specify your query with a filter on the year, Spark will be able to push down this predicate and say, hey, I only go and scan this single folder that contains data for the year of 2005.
Gotcha.
And that will give you 20x performance gain versus the case without partitioning.
Right, okay.
And partitioning can be multi-level, so you can have
I was going to ask, can you have sub, you know, partition on year and then month type of thing? Yeah. Okay.
That's a typical pattern how people go year, month, and then you have to choose is a day or week or something.
Cool. Now, am I where do I go partition the data? You know, am I going? How do I partition my data? I guess.
Yeah. So basically, it's a read and write process. So you read your data in the original format.
Oh, okay.
And then you create a new Hive table.
Okay. So, partitioning is basically structuring a structuring the folder and putting the data in the right folder.
Yeah.
Okay.
Structuring your data in the folder format and. Having the metadata in your Hive table that describes it in a way that Spark understands that, hey, this is a partitioning, like not some random folders, it's a partitioned folders where the name of the folder has the value of this year column.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
So basically, you need to create a partitioned Hive table in kind of a...
Oh, so when you create your Hive table, you're basically saying this is a partitioned Hive table, and here's
you,
the
structure. You specify partition key, you specify all of that.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Best practice there.
Yeah. Sweet. So you're ready to process your 10 terabytes
I'm ready to process my 10 terabytes of data. Let's go. How long will that take?
And final topic for today is caching, which is another very exciting topic.
Okay.
Actually, Spark was originally in its early days very kind of get famous because of its efficient in-memory techniques.
Okay.
And caching was one of them. Like there is a built-in command where you, for any RDD or data frame, you just say, you can just say, hey, cache it, and it will put it in a nicely distributed in-memory cache on your cluster.
Okay.
And then when it works from in-memory, it's like fast. So it's even faster than from Parquet.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so that's a theory, and that's...
However, you gotta not recommended.
Well, maybe we should have not started with that slide.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there is a problem with caching, which is unfortunately isn't very well known.
Yep.
And everybody kind of trickles. There is a different word. Stumbles upon it.
Yeah,
that's a word. On large data sets. So basically, the previous slide that we saw, the partitioning. So this magical partitioning technique basically doesn't work with caching, with native caching in Spark.
Okay.
That's, I would say, at this point, we can call it like a well-preserved limitation of open source Spark.
Right. Okay. This is why we do this show, because a lot of people don't know things like this, and we want to get this information.
Yeah, if you stayed till this point in our episode, you are now rewarded.
That's right. Thanks for watching up to this point.
Yes. There are many customers that spend some considerable time trying to understand what's going on.
Why is this not working?
Yeah, so it was working okay. Now I wanted to make it even faster. I cached this like huge terabyte data set in memory. And suddenly it doesn't work as fast as before. So what's going on? So the answer to this is when you cache a table, it basically loses its metadata about partitioning. So it becomes unpartitioned table.
Oh, interesting.
And,
okay.
And why
so you can still cache it. It just becomes unpartitioned.
It's still in memory, but you still need to now scan 20 years worth of data.
Okay.
In memory, but still 20 years versus a single year.
Right.
And in most of the cases, it's not faster than doing the single year, maybe of your remote storage or disk. And we can even take a look at how it looks like in the big query. So you kind of check for yourself when you run your query to double check, like, hey, do I have something wrong with my partitioning stuff or not? So the way to see it, basically, if you remember in the previous episode, we ran this query that finished in 17 seconds or 14, whatever it was. So if you run the same query, if you cache that data set and run the same query, we would arrive at 3 minutes time.
So that in the query we ran against the table, that was a partition table.
That was a partition table.
Okay,
yeah, it was heavily partition table.
Heavily partition table. Yeah. Now we're running it, caching it.
Yeah, so now we cached it, and we arrived at 3 minutes.
3 minutes, my goodness.
So that was like,
We lost more. We didn't gain, we lost 2.5 minutes.
Yes.
Or more than 2.5 minutes.
So the way to debug it and to understand it is to go into the one of the jobs that takes a long time, and they have it opened here, and look at how much data our tasks in our job, or stages in our job, retrieved. And we can see this telling number. So this job retrieved 1.7 terabytes of data.
Woo.
So that must, and that was all came from in memory. So that was awesome.
Yeah.
But it still took a lot of time, 3 minutes to do that. So if we look at the original job that didn't use caching and at the same screen, then we'll see that, hey, this partitioning, it only needed to retrieve 40 gigabytes.
Yep.
So that gives you like, what is it, 2 orders of magnitude difference.
Yeah, yeah.
So partitioning is important. And while caching is a powerful technique, there is limitations to that, at least using the native Spark caching.
Yep. Okay. Now, you got there, will be fixed in the future. Is there any time frame when...
So in 2.2, it's not on the radar. Well, I didn't look specifically, but I haven't heard at the high level any attempt at fixing it. So not at the moment, but fortunately there are very powerful workarounds for that.
Yeah, it's okay, which we're going to talk about
later. Yeah, so this is a tool that you can use instead to kind of fix it. So one of them is storage level caching. There are multiple projects in this area. One of them is Alluxio. Another one is Ignite, so you can use one of them.
Okay.
And basically, they will cache data at the level just before Spark.
Okay.
So for Spark, it will still look like a partition data set. It will still just read it. But then the storage layer will make sure that this data block that is being read from the storage is actually residing in memory or on the SSD, depending on how you configured it.
Yeah, okay.
So that's very kind of transparent automatic caching solution.
Okay,
very nice.
Good.
Works nicely. And alternatively, if you just don't want to install Alluxio, on HD Insight, for example, we have HDFS on the local cluster, which uses local storage.
Yeah.
So you can just simply copy your data into your local storage on the cluster.
Yeah, okay.
And then
cache it from
just simply run your queries from local HDFS.
And
in most cases, your SSD kind of storage on the cluster will be very close to the in-memory caching in terms of performance.
Okay. Got some options. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Sweet. Is there, what do you typically see from a caching perspective? I mean, one over the other here from a recommended, you know, I would almost say it depends, because if I'm running HD Insight and if I get rid of my cluster, I don't want to do this because there goes my HDFS, right? Type of scenario.
Yeah, yeah, good catch. The problem with a copy to HDFS workaround is that first, you need to spend time copying this whole thing.
Yeah.
And second, once you drop the cluster, it's gone.
It's gone,
yes.
Yeah.
So that kind of goes against the cloud kind of approach to the big data compute, where your compute is stateless and very nicely kind of you can create it on demand, process your data and drop it, and it's all kind of separated.
Yeah.
So that convenience goes away once you started copying into local HDFS.
Yeah. Okay. Do we still have that? Do we have that same limitation with Alluxio?
To some degree, yes. It's just not as into your face. Basically, if you drop your cluster, you will still lose all of your local cache.
Okay.
But when you recreate it and start querying it, your cache will automatically start populating again. So your first queries will still be slow. It will still go retrieve your data from the remote storage.
Okay. So there's still benefit to using that.
It gets into in-memory or into SSD. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Awesome.
So there is some warm-up time for the cluster that comes into play if you want to achieve the same level of performance as before. Yeah.
This is good information. Can we put links? So we'll put some links into the show to some of those, to some of the this information, to like Alluxio and things like that, and where they can go read more. But this is great information. I learned a lot. So awesome. So Maxim, thanks for coming.
Yeah,
this is
thank
great.
You for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's great to share this. Yeah.
Yeah, this is awesome. And I think there's some things that we talked about that, like you said, you know, we were talking before, that people don't know, like this, right? Where why is it slower, right? And
yeah, fortunately, we'll get less questions on that on that part.
That one, yeah. Going forward, yeah, good. So so we've got two more shows. We look forward to having you back for the third and fourth as we learn more about how to do Spark performance and things like that.
Yeah, look forward to it. In the next episode, we will start talking about more kind of advanced techniques to performance optimization.
Sweet.
Now we are out of the basic stuff. Yeah.
Good. Okay, awesome. Thanks for coming. This is always a pleasure to have Maxim in the studio.
Always a pleasure.
I learned a lot. Hey, everybody, thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.